This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This pandemic is uncharted territory for almost everyone. And among all the newness, this disease and the way countries are dealing with it are presenting a whole new set of academic questions. Stephen Feldstein is a professor of public affairs at Boise State University, and his recent article, What Democracy Will Fall Next, was just published on foreignpolicy.com. And he is joining us live today to talk about how democracies all around the world are dealing with coronavirus and just how stable those democracies are. Stephen, good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me as well.
Okay, so first, let's just break it down a bit. The title of your article, as I mentioned, is What Democracy Will Fall Next. You're talking about, coronavirus specifically. So what are the ways that this virus or the pandemic, or frankly, a crisis like this threatens a democracy?
Yeah, no, thank you for introing the article so well. I think really the question we're dealing with is that we're in a moment where there's a lot of political fluctuation, and that the pandemic has ushered in a ton of concerns when it comes to governance and who's in power and polarization and so forth. And so you have a bunch of democracies that already were dealing with pretty difficult issues, places where there was a lot of dissent, where there was a lot of polarization between political parties, places like India, Brazil, Poland, Israel, and so forth. And so I think what the pandemic has really done is it has accelerated some of these questions, and it's really forced a reckoning. Now, with Hungary, we saw that reckoning has occurred. And you've basically seen the first country that was a democracy turn into a country that is now, most people call it an autocracy, at least at the moment. Now, the question is, will other countries follow in that trend? And that's kind of what the article tries to delve into.
Okay, so if let's say you're worried about a democracy falling, is there a worry about what will replace it?
Yeah, so there's part of what I wanted to get into is that there are different categories of disruption, right? So some places you have what essentially looks like a consolidation of one leader's power. So you basically have the same political system continue, but that the power gets vested in one person. So it moves from being democratic to being more autocratic. Another one might be a place like Brazil, where you have such poor leadership by the president that you actually are run the risk of either replacing him completely through some kind of impeachment process, which would be fine, or having something worse like a military coup or whatnot occur because things are getting so bad. So that then leaves a whole set of questions about, well, what comes next? Is it democratic at some point later in form, or does it really move into a different type of system?
So you mentioned Hungary, and I want to go back to the beginning of your article, because the article begins, and I'm quoting this, in March, Hungary became the first democracy to succumb to the coronavirus. Its prime minister, you write, quote, jammed through an emergency decree that gave him extraordinary powers for an indefinite period of time, unquote. Now, you say that made experts, yourself included, start trying to figure out which democracy would come after Hungary. But can you talk about a little bit more in depth about what happened in Hungary and how that was able to happen?
Right. So what we've seen in Hungary over the past several years, actually even slightly longer, is through their president, Prime Minister Viktor Orban. He has slowly and systematically consolidated power in himself. He has outlawed different media outlets. He has delegitimized the opposition. And so we were already seeing a steady degradation when it came to politics and democracy in the country. When the coronavirus hit, he saw this as an opportunity to fully complete his plan that he already had in place, which is essentially to jam through and have parliament, which he controls, authorize an emergency decree that gives him such extended powers and gives him such discretion to ban critics, to ban the opposition, and to give him extraordinary abilities to control the country, that for all intents and purposes, for the foreseeable future, it has moved from being a democratic system to much more of an autocratic system. That's kind of the trajectory in terms of what we've seen in Hungary. And so that was the starting premise for a lot of us, is that, okay, Orban has done that. And a lot of other leaders are looking to what he's done and looking to the Hungary example. And they say, can I do that? Is that a possibility? How do I exploit this crisis for political gain? And that became the premise, the launching point in terms of saying, well, what happens next?
Okay, so then the question has to be asked, is there a concern that what happened in Hungary could happen here in the United States?
Well, you know, the difference in the United States and Hungary, it's a fair question, is that, you know, you've seen a really sharpened deterioration of the rule of law, accountability, and of institutions. And it also is a democracy that, frankly, is much younger. In the United States, we have much more established institutions. We have a longer tradition. And the deterioration that we've seen, and we have seen a deterioration under the current president, is not as bad. Now, that being said, depending on where the coronavirus goes, depending on what kind of norms are upturned, I mean, there's big questions even about what the election in November will look like. This could certainly lead to potential signs of greater upheaval. But I don't think we're there yet. And I don't think we're close to there yet. That doesn't mean I wouldn't watch what's happening here domestically.
Well, right. And so then what are experts on democracy and political governance saying about the U.S.'s response to the coronavirus?
Right. Well, I mean, there's I would separate it out in two. There is our public health response, which has been very mixed and frankly has been far inferior to other democracies like Taiwan, South Korea, Germany, which have done better. And then there's the kind of political polarization aspect in terms of the cleavages we've seen between people who want to open up and who don't, between the mixed messages we've seen from the president in terms of what actually is a viable treatment and what isn't. And I think, you know, there are certain political scientists who look across the world and say, what countries are most in danger because of the coronavirus of seeing a deterioration? And the United States doesn't rank in the highest tier, but it does place in the second tier. And that, I think, is right. So it's like a yellow light. It's not a flashing red light. I don't think that, you know, what we're seeing in Hungary is applicable right now, but there are warning signs and they are getting a little worse. And it's something to certainly watch.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Boise State Public Affairs Professor Stephen Feldstein about the stress that coronavirus is putting on democracies. Okay, so I do have to ask you, in your opinion, how is the U.S. doing right now? I mean, as you said, we need to keep our eye on it. Do you believe our democracy is safe and we will withstand this? Or are you and your colleagues worried that we're headed in a different direction?
Well, I've been worried about the state of democracy in this country for the last few years, to be honest. All the things that we look at that we think are important protections that need to be in place, protecting space for journalists and media, protecting the independence of different branches of government, ensuring things like inspector generals are able to operate without political influence, taking away the kind of corrupt aspects when it comes to self-dealing within the government. These are all things that we have seen a growing set of trends that I think point to worrisome signs. So I think on that score, in terms of how are we doing, well, our trajectory is poor. We are declining, and every single indicator that looks at kind of U.S. democracy over the last 3 to 4 years says that the main things that you look for are in decline. So that concerns me. We have an election coming up, and I think that's an opportunity to self-correct in some ways. And I think a lot of people are looking forward to seeing what that looks like.
Right. But as you said, we don't even know what that election will look like.
That's right. Right. I mean, I think as of the headlines as of today are that there's questions that are being raised by the president that are not based on evidence regarding mail-in ballots and fraud. Some people say there's a political motive behind that the reason one wouldn't want to go forward with mail-in ballots is that there's a perception that they favor one political party over another. That actually isn't borne out in evidence at all. But that's a line that's being used. And I think that really does damage to the idea of trying to get as many people as possible to have their voices heard in an election. And so these are the kind of things that people watch when they say, what are signs of deterioration, or what are signs that the legitimacy of an election are starting to be slowly peeled away at?
I also want to ask you a little bit about some of the human rights violations that we've seen in some democracies as a result of the pandemic. I mean, is this common to see human rights violations? I mean, this clearly in democracies?
Yeah, you know, so I would say this. I mean, first of all, in democracies, I really think of sort of two types. I think of liberal democracies, like, you know, countries in Europe, the United States, Canada, and others that have uphold pretty high standards. And that is, it's rare to see human rights violations occur. And even right now, we're not seeing much. But you have a second category of weaker democracies, democracies that, you know, have elections, but either have some form of a liberalism or kind of weak, places like India, Brazil, that have sort of autocratic leaders in place. And that's where you do see human rights violations come through on a periodic basis. And so anytime there's a big crisis like the coronavirus, and I can think of other crises in the past, you know, sort of like some of the terrorism crises that we've seen, there is a tendency for human rights to be the first thing to go, for the protections to get weakened in the name of security or the name of public health or the name of some other government response that's justified under national security grounds.
And in fact, I mean, a lot of people, you know, there's a faction of individuals who say that their human rights are being violated with these, you know, these stay-at-home orders. And then they, you know, try to say it's their constitutional right to not have to do this. However, there is, I mean, it is also in the Constitution that says that at a certain time, you know, for certain emergencies, I mean, I'm not quoting, but I'm giving, you know, kind of the overview, is that your rights can kind of be taken away for the greater good, one being this pandemic. Is that a correct assumption?
I think it is. I think it's always a balancing test between, you know, rights and the broader public interest. And the thing is, we don't enjoy unfettered rights in any area. Free expression is bounded by imminent harm, right? Like you can't yell fire in a movie theater precisely because the cost of doing so outweighs the benefit you would get from exercising your rights to free speech. By the same token, when it comes to public health, you need to very carefully balance the right to free association and to, you know, being able to go out of your homes and participate in the stream of commerce versus the danger it poses to a broader segment of society that might be susceptible to these infection rates. You know, frankly, the idea that the Constitution embeds a right to open businesses is not really true. There is, you know, it's everything within the Constitution is a balance of different rights and needs and protections of society.
Okay, so the title of your article is "What Democracy Will Fall Next." Do you have an answer?
You know, I it's very hard to prognosticate kind of these kind of right. things, right? I mean, the ones that I have sort of highlighted, I mean, I certainly am watching Brazil very, very closely. Whether that's just a leadership substitution or a broader, you know, kind of change of system, I think remains to be seen, but that's one. The Philippines is another one. Indonesia is a third. Poland's a fourth. Those are some of the ones, you know, that are listed in the article that I think are most worth watching. Others, Bolivia and Lebanon, are interesting in that they're very shaky as democracies. They barely rate as democracies. They're really on that line. And both of them were already undergoing huge protests and big transition problems. And then the coronavirus hit and everything kind of got frozen in place. Well, now it's kind of opening up again. And so what happens as restrictions are lifted actually will make for the next couple of months to be a really interesting test case in terms of where a number of these countries go. So there's a lot to watch, I think, on the horizon in the near future.
This is just a fascinating conversation and discussion. So I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us today about this.
Sure. No, I really appreciate having the opportunity. I really think we're in the midst of a lot of changes right now.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Boise State University Public Affairs Professor Stephen Feldstein about the state of democracy when governments face a crisis like the coronavirus pandemic. And if you would like to read his article, it was just published on foreignpolicy.com. Again, the name of the article, "What Democracy Will Fall Next." This is Idaho Matters.